from WXXI News. It's Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson. Our connection some mornings, honestly, is made between me and my bed. You just don't want to get up some mornings. You just feel like the world is caving in on you, like you can't even function in society in any given morning. We are talking about depression here on Connections this hour. It is a topic that is of a lot of interest, I think, to a lot of us. And I say us, I am a sufferer of depression. I was on here with Evan as a guest. And if you had asked me, if you'd put me up against the wall and said, when did you do that show with Evan where you're talking about depression? I would have said to you, it was probably, I don't know, 3 or 4 months ago that I was in here talking about it. It was September of 2020. Time has kind of taken on a dimension of its own that none of us can understand in the midst of a pandemic, as we're all dealing with so many huge factors out there that are so far beyond our control. And then on top of it, here we are at a moment when the days are getting shorter and shorter, and we are heading into wintertime. And for many who are sufferers of seasonal depression, that turns into an added factor. So not to bring you down on a Friday afternoon or anything, but that is the topic that we are going to be discussing with you this hour. And we do hope that we bring you in on it as well at 844-295-TALK or 263-9994. But we do have experts with us, both in the studio and on the phone with us. Eric Kane, MD, is with us. He is the former chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Welcome.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be back.
Good to have you with us as a frequent contributor to the show. Jerome Stiller, the owner of Thrive Health and Wellness, LLC, and also an In Our Own Voices presenter for the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Welcome to the studio.
Hi, everybody. It's great to be here.
Good to have you with us. This turns out to be inadvertently a sibling day because your sister was actually our guest coincidentally on the last hour. So we're all about family here. And then also with us online is Melanie Funchess, a mental health advocate, a member of the Greater Rochester Black Agenda Group and the Black Healers Network. Melanie, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon.
So glad you could be with us this afternoon. I joke about it a little bit. I guess that's sort of in my nature. But this is a serious, serious illness. This is something that can be completely debilitating for people, and particularly right now in the midst of a pandemic. How, you know, as we are now well into the second year of the pandemic, as we are all dealing with something that just is not coming to an end and is still affecting every aspect of our daily lives, how much worse, if in fact it is making it worse, how much worse is the pandemic making it for people who suffer depression and for the people whose job it is to try to treat it?
Well, you're looking at me, so I assume that's directed in this in my way.
Eric, go for it.
It's really clear that this has been something that, you know, you talk about 100-year floods or something of that sort. This is kind of like the 100-year or the 1,000-year flood. We'll use 100 since we had a pandemic about 100 years ago. And when you look at data that CDC's collected, for example, they're seeing among youth and among others who've been surveyed that there are just much higher complaints, much higher reports of, you know, depression, distress. You know, depression is such a general word. It's often, you know, we need to kind of break it down. But obviously, people are very burdened, overwhelmed. And the fact that, you know, we've thought that we had an end in sight, for example, by midsummer, and then, you know, Delta's come along and whacked us with another blow, makes it all the harder. You know, this is at times feels like an invisible enemy, and one that you can't really grapple with, get your hands around and struggle with. And yet there are a lot of things to do. This is not something that's hopeless. We're not, you know, helpless, but it feels that way sometimes. And so I think this is a really great time to have another discussion and really consider what we can do together and what people can do individually as well to kind of face the issues and deal with them.
Which is exactly why I wanted to bring you all together today. When Evan said, hey, I'm going to be off, what do you want to talk about? I'm like, oh, we could do this. This is worth revisiting. Melanie, I want to come to you first, just because I can't make eye contact with you in the studio. But is that, do you generally agree with Eric's perception of where we are right now?
Yes, I do. But additionally, I'd want to add that for communities of color generally, and for the Black community specifically, this is an even more heightened sense because we have been battling two pandemics, COVID-19 and racism 2020. Mm-hmm. In the midst of a global pandemic, when people who are naturally communal people become isolated, and then we were disproportionately affected by COVID on multiple levels in cases and being essential workers and all these other things. And you put on top of that the killing of Black bodies and people needing to take to the streets in the midst of a pandemic to advocate for your life against police brutality. I mean, you have all of these things coming together and in our own, and have this, and it's more, even more poignant in our own community here in Rochester because of Daniel Prude and a lot of the other traumas that have happened in the midst of the pandemic. But I want to agree with Eric to say that it is not hopeless. It feels like it's a lot, you know, like as the kids say, it's a lot, but there are ways and things that we can do to work toward our wellness.
And I'm glad to hear you making that point. And I want to come back to you. Don't let me miss this later in the show, because I want to come back to you also on the accessibility of mental health services to underprivileged communities too, and that factor. But I want to ask too, and especially you, Melanie, is there a sense? I know I kind of get the sense as this drags on, as we get longer into both the pandemic and into the societal issues, Melanie, that you're bringing up, I think there was sort of a sense, you know, at least in the summer of 2020, there were actions that could be taken. There were protests that were going on in a very organized, very high visibility fashion. There were, you know, people were out there thinking, oh, I can do something right now to, you know, whether it's just something as probably meaningless as hoarding toilet paper or making your own hand sanitizer or whatever. There's kind of a sense of, oh, I can do something right now to get a grasp on all of this. And it feels now, to me at least, you know, and maybe this is just kind of my own depression talking, but it feels to me like now it's just this long gray slog of days where these things just keep happening without a lot of ability to do anything about it. I look particularly, the statistics I look at every afternoon when they come out are the COVID case numbers and the hospitalization numbers, and they're just this flat line that is too high for where it ought to be at this point, and it's in the same place day after day without a lot of change, and I should probably stop looking at that, except, oh yeah, that's part of my job to look at it because I work in the news business. Am I perceiving all of this somewhat correctly here?
What I would say is, and I will speak from the perspective of, from myself, I do not speak for all Black people, I do not speak for all communities of color, but what I have seen is that there's work that's still happening. And this is something I know. You know, there's people trying to find a new way to find wellness, to find healing. The shift has happened where people are moving toward trying to find healing. But because of the pandemic and because we're still not getting together publicly in the ways that, you know, we are used to, a lot of that stuff is not as visible. But there are things happening. And I think, but I also think at the same time, that there is this long slog, that people are just, they're finished. They've lost their ability to can, you know, around COVID. People have COVID fatigue, and it's really hard because it's still impacting people in all kinds of ways.
And perhaps that is also something of a failing on our end, on the news media end, in not doing a good enough job, honestly, of covering these less visible. It's very easy, obviously, when there are thousands of people gathered at the Four Corners downtown for us to go down and report on it. And that is probably something we should be looking at more carefully in the news media, too. And I'm glad that you bring that up. Jerome Stiller, I want to bring you in on the conversation here as well. Let's talk a little bit about some of your perceptions and about some of what you are able to do to help bring people through this.
Well, Scott, the pandemic was really the perfect storm for mental illness. It was like one of the worst possible scenarios that one, especially someone who is already has a mental illness and struggles with that daily. Now, and this is going back to the beginning, now you've got to stay home. You've got to stay by yourself. There's this thing out there that is really, really frightening. And again, going back to the beginning of the pandemic in 2020, nobody really knew what this was. Okay? So now people already struggling with anxiety, well, everyone now has something to be anxious about. Okay? So if you're already struggling with a mental illness, now you've got kind of factual things out in the world that are confirming those internal feelings that you have that you struggle not to have.
Let's put some clarity here, because you bring up anxiety. We talked a little bit in the introduction about seasonal affective disorder. Where do you draw the distinctions? Because so many people that I know, have some combination of all of this, mm-hmm. have anxiety about doing things, have some form of generalized depression, and then, if you're anything like me, you're looking outside and thinking, oh my God, I got 3 hours of daylight left before it starts getting dark soon, and that whole seasonal piece of it. What are the distinctions that you draw?
Well, I think it's going to be very important to separate out what we might call demoralization from depression. A lot of people are demoralized and kind of feel stuck. Only some people are what we would call clinically depressed. And they require different kinds of approaches. I mean, Melanie already alluded to the idea of communities banding together, whether it's through faith communities, through common interest areas. And I think that we're seeing that now there are some lights at the end of the tunnel. We don't know how far they are away. But it's very clear that some people are resuming their lives. They've gotten vaccinated. They can go out. We're happening to sit in this studio without masks, full disclosure here. And I feel comfortable with this because I know I had my vaccination status checked. And so there are very important, instrumental, daily, structural things that can be done to begin growing a life again. Jerome is a trainer. He is physically active. I'm physically active. I can't underscore the amount of importance in terms of health promotion for people getting out and at least taking a walk, even on a gray day, or even in the snow that will come soon. The other side of it, though, is that there are some people really who need help, have to ask for help. Sometimes people won't ask for help, so at least accept help, accept a helping hand. And understand that there really are a lot of treatments out there, from psychological, psychotherapeutic, supportive, what we might call informal kinds of approaches, helping hands, to very formal clinical treatments. And so there are an array of resources. One of the challenges in this region, and I think around the country, we see it in the Veterans Health Administration, we see it in other places, is that many people have gone for care. And clinicians are full. Clinics are full, and there are waiting lists, there are other things. But at the same time, there are opportunities. So I always, in the midst of the dark days, also want to think about the light that comes shining through. But that's my nature, too.
And yet there is also, you brought up the ability to get back together. And in some cases, that brings with it its own oftentimes very well-established reasons for anxiety. We are here in this space because my employer here has set a policy that says you don't come in this building without proof of vaccination. There are lots of places where I could go and lots of things where I'd like to do where that policy isn't necessarily being followed, where people have largely stopped wearing masks, and where as much as I would love to have the community of being together and doing that with other people, at least for me, knowing what I know in part because of my job about the dangers of the Delta variant and living with somebody who is somewhat immunosuppressed, et cetera, that then adds its own whole layer of, wait a minute, this would be a nice thing to do and it would make me feel better on one level, but then I'm going to be completely nervous
I absolutely agree with you. And I think that one of the things that we know is this is a transitional time. We're not September 2020. We're not April of 2020, but we're also not fully out of the woods. And that transitional time raises tremendous amounts of uncertainty. And uncertainty is one of the hardest things for folks to deal with. And as you talk about, when, as Jerome alluded to, when someone has already some sort of mental health condition, uncertainty is a burden where you're just confronted with stuff. Jerome's shaking his head, so I'll stop talking.
Two things that I'd like to kind of amplify and expound on. One is that it's hard to draw distinctions, and sometimes distinctions are useful, sometimes they're not, in terms of things like depression and anxiety. Everybody gets the blues. Everybody worries about stuff. And now there's a lot of stuff to worry about. There's no clear demarcation line of where it becomes a mental illness. In severe cases, it's pretty obvious. But there are distinctions that need to be drawn between, am I feeling what everyone else is feeling in this kind of collective free-floating anxiety and this even free-floating depression? Is that what I'm feeling? Or is it something else? Is it something that's been with me a long time? Is this just a feature of it at this point? And I also think the good news, the very good news, is there is something simple that anyone can do at any time to help with all of those feelings, and that is get moving. Okay, you don't have to do an hour workout. You don't have to go to the gym. You don't have to run 5 miles. Just get up and get moving. Go for a walk. Remember that there is an outdoors, even in the winter.
Absolutely. And I'll get back to that. I've got a point on that in a minute. It's interesting. It's a good point that you make about not being able to draw an absolute distinction on that. I am also, in addition to suffering from depression, I am also diabetic. And I know if I go to my doctor, if he says, okay, your A1C has gone up from 7.1 to 7.8, I can quantify that and say, I know I have a problem there and I'd better work harder on my diet or my exercise. And then I can go back and see if that number has gone up or down. You can't really test brain chemistry that way, though, right?
There's more and more better research about looking at brain chemistry and brain imaging, but your point is absolutely correct. Mental illnesses are very often seen as very, very different things than physical illnesses, and they're handled in a very different way because you can't point to your depression, okay? You can take a rating scale and have numbers on a rating scale. And so a mental illness is not something that people want to talk about, that people are able to talk about. They don't have a language. It's embarrassing. It's still seen as a sign of weakness. If someone has cancer, you're going to be extremely supportive of them, of course, automatically. Okay, you're going to get, and there's going to be T-shirts and wristbands, and the person is going to be fighting a brave fight. If someone has a mental illness, you don't know what to say. You don't know what to do. And if that person is not doing well, they're not seen as a hero fighting a brave fight. They're seen as a loser.
And absolutely.
So that's part of that stigma.
I'm sorry.
I know you can't see me. I'm sorry. But I wanted to add something that's really,
I think is really important here,
is across different communities, mental illness is seen. It's a stigma across the board, but the level of stigma, I think there's levels to this. And I know particularly in many communities of color, it's, you know, the languaging. You know, I've spoken about this before, how, you know, I had been told, well, we survived slavery. You know, we survived Jim Crow. You know, why, you know, pull up your big girl panties. Mm-hmm. And it's like that, you know, and there's a whole narrative. And now with every, you know, with their one of this is a two-sided coin in this time, because everybody is feeling something, it's made it easier for people to, for a lack of a better term, to come out. You know, it's made it easier, and places that typically weren't having the conversation have started having it because it's something that now on some level is affecting everybody.
I am.
So we really need to really highlight that, like, this is tough.
I am more comfortable sitting here having this conversation now, certainly, than I would have been a few years ago doing it. I do want to get to the phones here. We have callers at 844-295-TALK, 263-9994 on this topic of chemical imbalance. Mike from Spencerport, welcome to the show.
Just have a question. Certainly with COVID, we know it's a stressor for everybody, but those people that are predisposed to depression seems to have exacerbated. What, biochemically, what is the basically the chemical imbalance, if you will, exacerbated by this COVID, and actually for any other stressor? Secondly, I have to be in healthcare myself, and you talk about the stigma of depression. I've found that I've made the best inroads of my patients being compliant taking medications. If I use the analogy of, if I told you you're a diabetic and you had to take insulin, if you will, there's clearly an imbalance. Your body is able to produce insulin. So much the same with a depression. You're lacking a chemical, and this medication we're giving you is no different than the diabetic taking insulin. So patients seem to be more receptive of that. I'll take my comments offline.
All right. Mike, thanks.
I just want to say that is wonderful that you're taking that approach, that you are educating your patients and relieving a lot of that stigma by saying, this is just an illness. We can diagnose it, we can treat it, and you can get better.
Let me try to address the question about the chemistry. You know, we really still don't know the fundamental, what we'll call neurobiology or neurochemistry of most psychiatric disorders, whether it's depression or schizophrenia. You know, we have our theories based on largely on how medications work. You know, we find the medication that seems to work, and then we say, oh, well, what's it doing? It's not quite the way we are looking at other kinds of medications. It's very important to understand that COVID generates tremendous inflammation in the body. We know that in COVID, there are a number of people who had no mental health problems, who develop a whole variety of very strong mental health problems or severe mental health problems. And this isn't simply that they're cooped up or it's environmental. This is also a reflection of the whatever is going on with COVID, either directly affecting the brain, and there's some evidence of that, but also the very tremendous power of inflammation. We know that inflammation is also involved with mood disorders. So the people who don't have COVID, but for example, there's a lot of research now on the relationship between inflammation and mood disorders. So there's a real tangle of factors. And this is one of those things where if you can, you know, set yourself some structure, if you can create a daily routine, if you can go out and walk and do those things, great. That can often deal with the kinds of problems. If you can talk with someone, you know, psychotherapy is very powerful when it comes to mood disorders. But there are going to be people in this situation who either never experienced anything before or who now are faced with all the challenges of COVID in the context of previous, you know, mental health conditions. And it's very important to seek help. I want to say one other thing, because Melanie was talking about different cultural factors leading to expression or acceptance or help seeking. There's also, you know, men, for example, although there are three out of the four of the discussions today are men, men often are less willing, less open, less accepting of help. And we know their suicide rate is higher. So far, the data in the United States would suggest that suicide's going down during COVID, somewhat paradoxically, perhaps, but the death rate from drug overdose has soared. So this is really a very, very challenging time for these kinds of conditions.
Let's talk about access to care, because, you know, you talk about talk therapy, for instance. And as I discussed the last time that I was on here sitting in the guest chair with Evan about this, my experience from previous battles with this is that was what worked best for me. And my sense right now, and I'm privileged enough to have a good health insurance plan, to have a primary care physician who I've been with for a long time, who I trust very much, and to have access to specialists. And, you know, most of the recommendations that have come back for me have been, well, keep trying this med, and then if that doesn't work, try that medication and try that medication. And this is, you know, this I've got access. If I needed to pay for some kind of private talk therapy, I could probably scrape together the money to do it. Obviously, there are a lot of communities, and Melanie, I know you particularly dealing with them, where that access just isn't there at all, right?
The access issue is multi-layered. You know, can you get to where the care is? Can you afford the care? Do they have capacity? But then particularly for communities of color generally, and for the Black community specifically, there's this issue of precision of fit. You know, this issue of do the providers that are available that you can access with your insurance, do they know how to do culturally responsive mental health care? Do, you know, because I don't think people really understand the exhaustion that it generates. And as someone who is currently in therapy, right, of when if you don't have that precision of fit and you having to explain Blackness, and explain, you know, and I've had tons of people in this time who were trying to seek out care who have come to me because of the Black Healers Network, because they're like, Melanie, I tried to tell them what happened and that the cop was doing this, and they said, are you sure that it was race? Mm. And so it's bad clinical care, but also there's times when there's language, there's all these other things that go into creating the bond. The bond between a clinician and a client is one of the most intimate bonds that you can have. And we need to have people who can have alignment. And so it's not, I mean, being skin folk is not enough. Being Black is not enough. It's also knowing how to do culturally responsive interventions with the people that you serve.
Excellent point. And again,
and that creates a whole other set of barriers for a lot of people.
And this still assumes that you have insurance that can pay for it. And that,
yes, I mean, that's after all that.
Right. Wow.
There's one thing that can really positively impact mental illness and people with mental illnesses that's not necessarily access to care issue at all, because it's not formal care. Now, there is no substitute for psychotherapy. There is no substitute for medications. But there's also another component, which is the social component, family, the social surround. And if you can't talk about what you're feeling, if there just isn't a safe space for you to do it, you're not going to be able to talk about it, and it's going to get a lot worse. At the same time, even if you are receiving adequate clinical care, if you go home and you still can't talk about it because people don't know how to talk about it, they don't want to talk about it, and you're ashamed of yourself, that makes it very, very difficult for that clinical care to be effective.
Absolutely.
So much more to talk about on this very pressing issue of depression as we continue this heading into the weekend Friday conversation here on Connections, with actually more coming up, as you'll hear in a second. On Monday's show, we will be back after a quick break. We invite you to call in and join us, 844-295-TALK. 263-9994. Connect with me on Twitter at Scott Feibusch, and we will continue with our panel right after this.
I'm Megan Mack. Monday on The Next Connections, we continue our conversations with candidates for Rochester City Council. Our goal is to talk to all of the candidates on the ballot about their issues and priorities for Rochester. So we'll hear from two more candidates on Monday. Then in our second hour, research shows that mental illness and suicide rates are up among physicians. We'll talk to people in the medical field about burnout. Talk to you Monday.
Welcome back to Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch, sitting in for Evan Dawson as we continue our discussion about depression in the time of COVID. It's a conversation we've had before. It's one I suspect we'll be having again more than once before this is all over. We invite you to join us at 844-295-TALK or 263-9994. On the line with us remotely is Melanie Funchess, a mental health advocate and a member of the Greater Rochester Black Agenda Group and the Black Healers Network. In studio with us, Jerome Stiller, owner of Thrive Health and Wellness and in Our Own Voices presenter for the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and Dr. Eric Kane, former chair of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Rochester Medical Center. As we get into the second half of this, I want to go back to the phones here for a moment. I want to get Alexis on the air here to talk specifically. Alexis, you've dealt particularly with seasonal depression. Tell us a little bit about what you've dealt with and what you found that's worked for you.
Absolutely. So seasonal depression for me has been an ongoing struggle ever since I moved here to Rochester from D.C. And what I found that really helped me is self-discovery and digging deep and asking myself some of those tough questions that I usually want to avoid. So those questions for me, it's like it gets to the root of my actions, my thoughts, and like my emotions. And, you know, I believe it was Jerome earlier who was, you know, saying basically to question yourself, right? You're asking yourself, am I feeling what everyone else is feeling? Questioning for me is just so powerful. You know, you ask yourself, where am I in this moment? What am I feeling mentally, physically, emotionally? Especially, I know Melanie was talking about, you know, I'm a Black woman, right? She was talking about how, you know, people in the Black community sometimes often feel that therapy isn't for them. You know, that mental illness isn't something that we can experience, but it is, and it's something that we definitely experience every single day. And with that, with experiencing that, we feel like sometimes, you know, we don't want to go to therapy or we're not sure of the first step to take. And for me, what's really helped is asking myself those powerful questions, those tough questions. And it's something that you can do as a first step to really start moving towards therapy if that's what you want to do, if that's the route that you want to take. But those powerful questions is what really helped me. Like, where am I right now? What emotion am I feeling? You know, what's making me anxious? Just really getting to the root of those questions. What does your inner voice sound like? So questioning is definitely a tool that I've used, and I've used it to even help me journal and just to get those ideas and feelings and emotions out to get through another Rochester winter.
So how does the seasonal depression affect you? For people who haven't lived through it, who don't suffer with it, what makes it especially bad for you?
Yeah, so for me, color is a huge thing. And when I go outside or when I open my window and all I see is gray, it makes me feel that gray as well, right? It's something that I find myself just wanting to be closed off from people. I find myself being isolated. I start to feel lonely, as if, you know, I'm not needed or I'm not wanted, or as if even I don't have, you know, friends, when the reality is I do. I have people that I can reach out to and that I can connect with and talk to. But the feeling is that there's no one there. I'm in a pretty full house. I have a 4-month-old and I have a 4-year-old and I have a husband. And even with being surrounded by so much energy every day, there are moments when I feel alone, completely alone. I can hear a baby crying in a different room and I still feel as if I'm alone. And it's that time of year that can be so lonely. And at the same time, it's a joyous time of year. We have all the holidays coming up, right? And so while so many people may on one hand be feeling like, oh, I'm so excited, you know, about family time, getting, you know, into the holiday spirit, at the same time, you have so many other people who are feeling that even with so many people around, you still feel alone. You still feel by yourself. And that's a very real feeling. And for me, again, a way for me to come out of that is to just really sit in that moment and then think through it, think myself out of it in a way with those questions, with journaling, with getting it out, with talking to someone. But for me, the feeling is just like I just feel sometimes alone, even when there are so many people around.
I sympathize with you on that. I find a lot of times, for me at least, the last thing I want to do is to be hearing my own internal monologue, and I don't want to be confronting it more directly, and I want to be able to find a way to turn it off and tune it out. And
so there are a lot of things to do, though, for seasonal affective disorders, it's called, or SAD. Mm-hmm. You know, one of them is to have a very structured schedule. You get up at the same time every day. You maintain your biological rhythm, because one of the things that, you know, we're so much, all of us, but some of us more than others, are very attuned to the light. And so you need to be able to really, as it were, set the clock and keep that pattern going, even when you feel like you need a crane to get you out of bed. You were describing not wanting to get out of bed. I often envisioned people needing a crane to lift them up. And light therapy is very, very effective. You know, being exposed to light at the right time of day can be powerfully effective. And, you know, there are no side effects to this as long as you make sure you don't have the inappropriate UV exposure from the wrong kinds of lights. So that there are lots of things to do. You know, some people find their appetite increasing a lot, and you want to actually be careful about what you eat and how you think about your diet and your nutrition. And as Jerome says, those are the times when you need to get outside. There is some light in Rochester year-round. Rumor has it the sun still does rise in the morning. And so, you know, when you know, this started to become much more a topic of conversation in the 1970s, really, going back, and people started recognizing it much more. You know, they started doing some very fundamental stuff. And so, you know, all the self-questioning, the self-examination is critically important. But there are some really, as I call it, instrumental things that can make a difference in life. And so, again, this goes back to my optimism that there are ways that we can have an effect on this.
I was born in Rochester, but I lived in Colorado for almost 30 years. And we used to say that Colorado gets 300 days of sun a year and Rochester gets the rest. And when I knew I was moving back here, I bought a light box while I was still in Colorado and brought it with me. And I used it every winter. And what I found from my experience was it certainly helped. Okay, it wasn't a cure all by itself, but it certainly helped quite a bit. And that's really readily available. The problem with a regular schedule, although it is very, very useful to do that, is often if you're suffering from a mental illness, particularly depression, is, yeah, that would be great, but I can't do that. I wish I could get up every morning at the same time. I wish I could get out of bed, period. But it is just as unavailable to you as flying is. It's not possible. Also,
I want to add to that, when you can't do it, the feeling of failure.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because you're saying that you're setting this goal that I'm going to get up every morning at 8 o'clock and I'm going to brush my teeth and I'm going to take a shower. And when you can't do that, you know, and it's normal because you're depressed, right? And you can't do that, but then you feel that you failed yet again, yeah, and you're worthless
worse.
Yet again.
And I went through that last fall where I had a lot of the work that I do when I'm not here is project consulting work, and there were some clients that just didn't get the work done for them, and then that adds to that burden because there are weeks that I can't really account for completely from the fall of 2020.
So one of the lessons for that, and again, this goes to prevention and sort of Jerome's comment about that is, if someone knows that they have recurring seasonal affective disorder, then you start your light box early. You don't wait until the condition has begun. Because as you say, once you're full blown, you're not going to get out of bed. It's the whole thing of how do I have this self-awareness? Prevention's possible. It's not 100%, but we know that it is something that can be done. For some people, they start their antidepressant medication again, little by little by little, in anticipation of what they've seen as a recurring problem. It's obviously very individual. It's obviously a challenge. In the midst of it, once you're in the throes of it, then your approach has to be different.
And my experience certainly concurs with that completely. Getting out in front of it, getting out in front of my depression, knowing that it's coming on, and starting to do things that in the past, I would wait until I was bottomed out before I would talk to someone, before I would have a medeval, before I would say to myself, what is it that I'm doing right now? But getting out in front of it, preventative, sitting in front of your light box, getting used to movement, walking, exercise, getting used to eating well, making those things just part of your life has so much, it's just tremendous value in dealing with depression and anxiety.
We are talking about depression here on Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson. Our guests this hour are Eric Kane, the former chair of the psychiatry department at the U of R Medical Center, Melanie Funches, On the line with us, a mental health advocate, member of the Greater Rochester Black Agenda Group and the Black Healers Network, and Jerome Stiller, who owns Thrive and Wellness LLC and is a presenter for the National Alliance on Mental Illness. I want to echo from my own experience what you're saying about having those goals sometimes. I told myself at the beginning of this year, and it was just sort of a spur of the moment, I think on like New Year's Eve last year, I said, you know what, I'm going to go out and I'm going to walk every single day in the year 2021. And I had done a lot of walking last year. I agree. I found it was a way to get out. I said, okay, I'm going to walk the entire Erie Canal through Monroe County in stages. And I did that. I was really bored during the pandemic, so I'm going to walk every residential street in the town of Brighton. I did that. So I said, this year I'm going to walk every day. And it's interesting because I've kept up with it. And I've done nearly a mile every day, even sometimes when I've had to work it in while traveling. But I can feel that these next couple of months are going to be the hard part, that there are days now where, boy, it's cold out there, there's no daylight, I don't want to have to go out and do a mile just for the sake of having accomplished this stupid goal that I set for myself at the beginning of the year that I'm too stubborn to get out of now, even though I know also it's pushing me to get out there and do this thing that usually is making me feel better.
What I tell my clients is there's a million reasons not to exercise. It's too cold. It's too difficult. It's too this. It's too that. And all of those are true. You can't fight against those. But if you can remember that I'm going to feel great afterwards, if you can just hold on to that and say, even though I do not feel like doing this, I'm going to do it anyhow because I know I'm going to feel better afterwards.
Except for the days when you come back soaked to the bone because it's snowing.
This also gets to what Melanie was talking about, community. You don't have to walk alone every day.
Right.
You know, part of the thing to do is to say, well, you know, I'm going to set it up that I can walk with someone else who will knock on my door or who will say, hey, I'm looking for you. You know, we don't have to struggle with these things alone. One of the themes that that we always talk about is how do you own your condition? You know, we had some discussion earlier in the week about breast cancer, and we've talked about diabetes, and there are all sorts of things that, you know, have been on this show. And it's all about taking ownership. And whether it's as Melanie describes it or Jerome or whatever, it's being open about it. You know, our caller was just a wonderful example, our previous caller, of taking ownership and really understanding these are the things that I have to do. It may be different for among different people. But the idea that someone can, as it were, look this in the eye and then say, hey, I'm going to deal with this. I mean, you're saying that you're going to walk every day, and yes, it's going to get harder, but maybe you get a friend to help you get out that door, put on that coat, and remind you to take an umbrella, perhaps.
I got a dog pushing me to do it, too. She helps also.
Okay.
Harry from Rochester emails in and says, as he's out, people are waving and gesturing to strangers in the street during the COVID period. What about encouraging gestures? And I know I do a lot of walking, like on the Brickyard Trail, which is near me in Brighton. And yeah, sometimes I try to wave to people, and I try to smile, and sometimes I get a wave and a smile back. And sometimes people are so lost in themselves, and sometimes I think, boy, they're being unfriendly. And sometimes I just want to give them space and say, you know what? I've been out here sometimes where I don't necessarily want that contact either. I just need to be by themselves. Is there a space for that? Is there room? I guess the question, you know, I'm thinking about a doctor's appointment that I was at where they do the screening questions, right? Where you walk in and the nurse says to you as you're getting screened for your blood pressure and your heart rate and everything, there's the questionnaire about, have you had multiple instances in the last however of feeling down about things or of being worried about things? And I just looked at it the last time. I said, I work in the news business. I cover what's going on. It would be really weird if I didn't. How much of this is just normal for us right now?
Well, you know, again, Melanie touched on this, you know, and I have known her for many years. You know, you take someone who is in the Black community, we understand all the issues of COVID and, you know, the differential deaths and access to care and then what happened last summer or what's still happening around the country. And context makes a difference. There's no question that we're sensitive to context. Sometimes, you know, I'm sitting with my partner and we're saying, oh, you know, we've heard too much COVID news today. It's kind of like, when are we going to, you know, pay attention to something else? And so I think this is part also of how we try to arrange our lives to have some entertainment, to actually do things that are fun, to try to, again, preventatively think about how do I engage myself in a fashion so I don't always dwell on the awful, because there are some, you know, people who say hello and, you know, flowers that grow and parks that are about.
I think there's also kind of a behavioral answer to that question of, is this just the normal depression and anxiety everyone is feeling? So what does it do for you? Does it make you feel bad? Of course it makes you feel bad. Does it get in the way of you living your life? Then it's serious. So I think that's a good demarcation. Can you still go on with your life? Pretty much, maybe not as happy. When you start being unable to get out of bed, when taking a shower is a big accomplishment for you, okay, that's the sign that something is much more than just the background difficulties of living right now with COVID.
Absolutely. And when I talk about this, I talk about the double Ds, right? Duration and degree. And so how, you know, there's levels. What is the degree to which this is affecting your daily life? And what is the duration for it's been going on? And for me, in my own journey, there's a couple of things that I've done. Like, one, I have two accountability partners. We text each other every morning. And if they do not get a text from me by a certain time, they're calling. And this is every day. This has been every day for the last 12 years, right? This is what we do. And then also, I was introduced to the concept of a wrap plan many years ago, and it's been the best thing, because what it is, it's almost like an advanced directive. When you are well, you know, you can know some of the signs that you are not doing as well. And I have some outward signs that to people who don't know me as well, they would seem perfectly normal, but I put them in my plan and I communicated them. Like, if you see me three times and my nails are not done, if you see me wearing sneakers and jeans at the same time, if you see, if you see me, if you see me without earrings, right? And most people wear sneakers and jeans together. I never do that. So if you see me doing that, that means I couldn't get anything on my feet that morning.
We're all looking at our sneakers and our jeans in the studio right now and feeling,
you know, but the thing is, having friends who know those things, know that when you see those things and there's not a real reason for it, it's time to ask Melanie some questions. And we even have the questions that you need to ask. And because I've enlisted these people as my accountability partners, I have to tell them the truth.
And that's a wonderful example of you owning your condition, how you feel. You're owning your feelings. You know what they are. And you're being vulnerable enough to share them with people who care about you.
So I want to jump in here because I've got some of those myself. If I'm being snarky on Twitter and talking about how you should come see me do comedy tonight or whatever, I'm probably in an okay place. If I go completely silent for a week, that's the point where I want the people who are friends with me to check in and say, hey, is there something going on?
Have you told them that?
I probably should. But at least I know
absolutely.
And at least I know that, here's the thing, though. At least I know that there are people that I could go to like that and say that to. I worry about the people who are out there who don't even have that resource in their life. Who are we missing out there who doesn't have that network?
Well, this brings up the whole issue of, I called it owning before. Jerome's talked about that. The idea that you're open to yourself enough. You know, as I said, our previous caller was talking about how she was open to herself. She asked questions about herself. It's very clear that a lot of people are not that way, you know, until it overwhelms them, you know, that it's so threatening. You know, you see this in folks who are to accept that they're hurting, to accept that they are having a hard time functioning or dealing with things or being, you know, the person they were when they were feeling better, but they don't say, I'm feeling bad. And so, you know, this gets to our broad cultural values. You know, we have this, broadly speaking, individually oriented culture. You know, it's much less collective in the broad sweeping generalities. Clearly, there are some, you know, groups in our culture, populations in our culture that are much more collective. But if, you know, there's so much that is, I've got to deal with this myself. And it, again, often is among men. And we see that they, you know, go on to die that way. And so, part of what you're getting at is how do people have that self-awareness such that they can then say, I need to ask for someone's help. And then the next step is, well, whom would I ask? And that's a very hard progression for a lot of people. Yeah. And they might start by saying, well, I'd have no one to ask. Probably there is someone out there, but you have to be ready to put out your hand or say, help me.
And ultimately, you can't force people into it if they don't want to go there.
That's
unless it gets to some sort of a crisis situation.
Right. Well, you can't force the individual to for himself or herself to say, for themselves to say, hey, I need help. But you could certainly at times approach people and say, gee, it seems like things aren't going so well.
We are getting down to our final minutes here. So really quickly, starting with Melanie, I want each to just give me one quick resource that maybe people don't know about where they can turn to if they feel like they need help.
If you need help, and this is specifically around people of color who are looking for culturally responsive mental health treatment, Sankofa Family Counseling is available, and they have all kinds of ways to increase access. And they're located in the city on Portland Avenue. They are great. They do telemed. They do all the things. So please just Google Sankofa Family Counseling, and they will work with you.
Jerome and Eric, really quickly.
National Alliance for Mental Illness, Rochester, NAMI Rochester. They've got groups. They've got all kinds of resources available.
Eric?
Well, it's very clear that there are a number of places that will take people who can't pay well, whether they're mental health clinics at the different hospitals or St. Joe's. You know, these are places that are open and have open doors.
Excellent. Dr. Eric Kane, Melanie Funchess, and Jerome Stiller, thank you all so much for being with us for this very important conversation on Connections. As I say, I suspect we will be doing it again at some point. I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson, with big, big thanks to Megan Mack, Emma Ray Stein, and Rob Braden. Happy birthday, Emma Ray. Evan will be back on Monday. Thanks for being with us on Connections.